This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jenny Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today are Professors Elizabeth Euler from the University of Pittsburgh and Catherine Saltzman Lee from UC Santa Barbara, two experts on pre-modern Japanese literature and theater. Their new edited volume, Cultural Imprints, War and Memory in the Samurai Age, was recently published by Cornell University Press. This volume draws from fields of literature, artifacts, performing arts, and historical documents to examine how warfare was viewed by various groups of people. So, welcome, Elizabeth and Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, can you tell us what your research focuses on and how did you begin working on this volume together? I guess we can start with Elizabeth first.
Actually, I think I'm going to hand this over to Catherine, who really is the heart of this project.
Well, I'm not the heart of the project, but I originally organized a conference that was called War and Remembrance, Cultural Imprints of Japan's Samurai Age. And the idea of the conference was to explore that the idea that in wartime or peacetime, over the seven centuries during which samurai ruled, that the workings of memory, especially ideas about the samurai, were central to the cultural development and cultural production in Japan. And the concept of cultural imprints was in there, and Elizabeth was a major participant in that conference, and out of that, she and I decided to do the volume. Many of the people who were in the original conference have participated in the volume, but we also had many discussions about who to add and where we had a couple spaces or a few spaces to add to for people who we thought were their work was especially relevant as a result of discussions in the conference and after the conference. So that was the inception. I should say that Elizabeth and I go back a ways because we had the same graduate advisor, Professor Susan Matisoff of Stanford, and then later of Berkeley. So we came out of thinking about things perhaps in similar ways, or at least interest in some similar areas. Elizabeth mostly works in the medieval, so-called medieval era. I work in early modern, but even so, we look at similar things. And we had the great honor and pleasure to do a conference together in honor of our advisor. And that was actually the first time we met. This was long ago now, because I was at Stanford as a graduate student way before Elizabeth. So we met during the conference and we really liked working together. And then the later history of that other conference and then doing the volume. As far as my research is concerned, as I say, I look mostly at early modern theater. I've done a little bit of work on No. That was something I originally studied, but I later switched into kabuki during my graduate studies. And I'm interested in kabuki as a performing art and as a cultural significant part of the Edo period. I look at the printed materials associated with kabuki, so vast number of treatises and printed encyclopedias and memoirs, and well, not exactly memoirs, but you know, ideas about acting that get recorded often by disciples, sometimes by actors themselves, the woodblock prints, to look at theater history, cultural history, and in some cases, of course, details of performance, but also the kind of larger meanings of kabuki in the Edo period, which led to some of the questions for this volume.
That's wonderful how you get to, after all the years that you get, your paths cross again. So, and Elizabeth, what do you work on?
I'm, as Catherine said, I'm mostly a medievalist, and my main focus has been Heike Monogatari, the tale of the Heike, and things that are connected to it. And I will say, I think one of the common points that both of our research has is kind of trying to place the things that we work on in larger cultural contexts and in conversation with other things that are, you know, happening at the same time, and how the things that we're looking at respond to and also, you know, activate other kind of interpretations, whether it be, you know, in the realm of performing arts, or, you know, in my case, it's mostly in performing arts, or with Catherine, you know, kind of going well beyond that into the material culture around kabuki. We're lucky, I feel particularly lucky to have an interlocutor like Catherine, to kind of, who is coming at things, looking at a different set of texts, but, and, you know, practices and a different time period, but always comes at, is helps me formulate interesting questions about my own work, and I'm looking at an earlier period. I am probably more fundamentally invested in things that commemorate war. You know, I'm interested in Tale of the Heike. The work I've done on No has also been kind of focused on plays that are that kind of are reworkings of the Tale of the Heike on the No stage. But I'm always, I feel very lucky to be able to bounce ideas about that off with Catherine. And, you know, really our first experience, as she mentioned, we didn't intersect at Stanford, although it wasn't that many years between when she was there and I was there, but working on the conference for Susan Matisoff really allowed us to see how, you know, this kind of collaboration and thinking through things together really helps build, you know, really interesting projects that draw in lots of ideas and can be really exciting.
Yes, I completely agree. And that's wonderful. And I guess we can return to talking about your research a bit later. But for now, can you tell us about this volume? What does it cover?
Well, as the title suggests, cultural imprints, we're looking at the samurai age. And what we want to do with this volume, and what, you know, our many contributors are doing as well, is looking at specific responses to and interpretations of the importance of warriors and war and warrior culture in Japanese culture from the 13th through the 19th century. So in doing that, we're kind of defining a long period that we're investigating. And we want to think about, or we, you know, our various, the authors are all thinking about what it means to be a warrior in for warriors, for other members of society, looking at warriors and in different ways over this long, you know, this seven century long period. And we're, you know, fundamentally in our, you know, in our title, we're looking at the samurai age. We're looking at what it means to be a samurai, and also what, how different disciplines today treat that concept. You know, when they are looking, what, you know, what period they're looking at, what specific kinds of texts they're looking at, or other kinds of documentation they're looking at. So we've got a number of we have chapters by historians, by art historians, by theater people, by literature people. So we're looking from a lot of different disciplinary perspectives at kind of remnants of samurai culture throughout this seven century long period.
Yes, and I would just add or strengthen the fact that the various materials that our authors are looking at, some of them are looking back in time, and others are concerned with the present. So there's, you know, that's one other interesting thing that we found in trying to look at the centrality of the meanings of the samurai during these 700 years.
You mentioned something very interesting. So this book, The Samurai Age, you mentioned they are focused on the 7th century, but the Western audience, especially after the Netflix show on the Age of Samurai, probably tend to associate samurai with the war period during the 14th century, the so-called Sengoku period. So what's going on? Why is there such a confusion? Which one is the actual samurai age?
Right. So that's, you know, that's certainly, if you asked our students too, it's not only that, but it's, you know, what does a samurai look like in a video game, or what, you know, so, or in an anime. And so, you know, this concept of the samurai, right, is something that is really important, and we all have an image, whether you're in Japan or whether you're in another country. Like, the idea of the samurai is something that is coherent. But of course, we, as, you know, scholars of Japan, know that what it meant to be a samurai and the existence of samurai wasn't just this moment in time during the Sengoku period, during the Warring States period, but it, you know, it has its roots in the Heian period, and it has these manifestations that occur in what we call the medieval period, in the, you know, from the Kamakura through the Muromachi period, and then we have the Warring States period, and then samurai is a codified class in the Tokugawa period. So what we decided to do was look at how this period, during which warriors were, you know, putatively or in reality, kind of dominating the political and, in many cases, social spheres, and see how that concept of the samurai changes over time, what pieces of it kind of cohere and kind of morph in ways that keep some consistency over the stretch of those 700 years. But exploring the multiplicity and the differences and the very kind of complex things that could be called part of samurai culture, you know, everything from a robe that is used in an ope to somebody's letters, right? That how these demonstrate, you know, they explore different aspects of what it meant to be a samurai. And we're looking at works that are by members of the warrior class, or patronized by members of the warrior class, or by people who are outside of the warrior class at these various times. So, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is complicate the idea of these kind of medieval versus early modern idea of the samurai, because there's so much, you know, there's so much change that happens over that time, that period of time, and yet acknowledge that. So we're acknowledging on the one hand that there is an idea of a warrior and the word samurai associated with it, but that changes over time, not only at the moment when, you know, medieval gives way to early modern, which is, you know, and we do look at the complexity of that moment in this volume, but also during the medieval period and over the course of the Tokugawa period.
Catherine, would you like to add something?
I would just like to add that one of the things that we worked with here was that we've expanded. We're calling the samurai age something very, very long. But at the same time, we're trying to break down a kind of, you know, one idea about what samurai are, as you said in your question. And so that was always something we had to work with, getting, you know, arguing for a longer period, but at the same time arguing against any kind of ahistorical idea of what the warrior is, which we felt was best done by looking at these different so-called imprints. And also best done through interdisciplinarity, as Elizabeth just said, so that we can kind of multi-perspectives and multi-methodologies would help cut away at any kind of, one way of looking at samurai.
So I absolutely loved the interdisciplinary approach throughout this whole book. And I want to talk about this cultural imprint concept more. So what kind of practices do you look at in this discussion of cultural imprints? And I guess, echoing what you said earlier about your interest in war, how did you settle down on this discussion of the imprints of war on cultural practices of the 7th century and a bit afterwards as well?
War, because what we discover is that war matters over the entire long period. Warriors are actually fighting before the end of the 16th century, but they're not fighting once you get into the 17th century or soon into the 17th century. So there's, you know, it looks very different on the surface. But what we found was that memory of war is something that goes throughout. It starts actually very early, you know, where warrior identity in the early medieval era is shaped by narrative arts, and cultural depictions then are very critical all the way through. They change dramatically in the Tokugawa period. They kind of narrow to more of an ideal that gets solidified, again, often through cultural practices, performing arts, literary works, oral narrative, continuing from the medieval period. And so I think in terms of your question of why war, because war really is central the whole time, whether it's being fought or not. The imprints that we have chosen, we use this word cultural imprints, and it was a term that was there in the original conference and became really important when we thought about the volume. And the idea is that these are, you know, in each case, a specific focus, so specific, but varied cultural practices, not just the different methodologies in looking at them, but the practices themselves, all trying to focus on war and memory. I think we defined it as traces. We use the word traces that hold specific historical meanings, but that also continue through time. So something like the tale of the Heike, it goes back to the earliest part of our long period that we're looking at, and yet it goes all the way through. And it's so we try to follow that. So this idea of cultural imprints was important to us. Anything that has left that trace, a practice or something that leaves a trace, that then has it's not just a trace and it's sitting there, but somehow continues to have an effect. So we had the idea that you needed a range of practices. Even within four of the essays or chapters address performing arts, but even within that, they are very different kinds of orientations in terms of what the authors are doing. So again, we go from kind of specific memories and commemoration for individual war dead in a kind of religious context to the, you know, getting as time goes by, shifting to kind of perceived experiences and the challenges that warriors faced, especially in the Tokugawa period, for reasons that I've mentioned, and also where their experiences become a kind of community experience. They get shared on a wider level than just among samurai themselves. A couple examples of this, you know, why do we think we need these cultural imprints to learn about the samurai age or to understand our samurai age? I think that we found that if we have a range of practices, that it helps kind of set down the idea a little bit. Just to highlight a couple of the chapters in the book, Monica Beta wrote one of the essays, which is very oriented towards something material. This essay is called In Memorandum, Dragonflies and Drums. And she's looking at a garment worn by an important figure in the 15th century, in connection with a performance that was dedicated to the repose of a recently deceased shogun. So, of course, somebody of the samurai class. And what's interesting is that she kind of contextualizes the use of the robe. It was a robe that is used for the performance of a particular rite called the Kannon Sembo, and she traces this robe from first being a warrior costume, then to being a monk's robe, then back to the secular world of performance, which is that performance that she talks about. And then it gets, in a sense, re-ritualized through this incorporation of the rite into the play in a variant practice in memory of a deceased warrior. So much can be told just through tracing that. Just one other of our contributors, Andrew Goebel, who writes an essay called Memento Mori, Mori Warriors, Manase Physicians, and the New Medico-Cultural Nexus of the 16th Century. And he's looking at the relationship between warriors and other cultural figures, in this case, a family of physicians, and he looks at their correspondence and other documents. And he's looking at how individuals position themselves and their families at a time when the future was very uncertain, because this is really kind of when you're in this period with Hideyoshi and all those terrible wars going on at the end of the 16th century. So these are just a couple examples of some of our so-called imprints and what they can illuminate and why we felt that to understand the samurai age at its various junctures, dipping down as it were to, you know, put our feet on the ground at various points and try to see what's going on.
And if I could just add something to that, thinking of one of the other essays that we have in the collection, and this one is by Marimi Tateno, and it is entitled, let me look at the title, Hideyoshi and Okuni's Kabuki, Memories Preserved in a Screen Painting. This is another, several of these have wonderful, wonderful images in the book itself. We're really lucky to have really good images. And this is, you know, she's looking at a screen painting that is generally used to think about early kabuki and okuni performing kabuki, but she's really making an argument for its actual, the the circumstances of its production. And she, like other scholars before her, you know, see one of the viewers in the stand as Hideyoshi. And then she builds an argument by kind of a very careful art historical detective work to pose that this was probably a memorial painting. And when you look at this as something that is intended to commemorate Hideyoshi and be a memorial for people close to him, that also situates him and he's at one of these really important turning points between the medieval period and the early modern period. And he in this painting appears to be kind of a samurai of the medieval period, someone who is as a warrior in power, looking towards the aristocracy and aristocratic practice for legitimation. And yet he's in his very modern finery. And he's also in this situation where he is embracing this new sort of theater that is emerging. And so we see him in this material object, the screen, that is commemorative. It's a memorial sort of text in itself, looking to a whole lot of different ways that samurai, the word samurai, or, you know, the conception of a samurai leader, carries meaning both, you know, at the moment during which he lived, also the moment in which the painting was made, which was shortly after his death, and then for the generations that appreciated it moving through the Tokugawa period and beyond.
I'm so glad you brought up this chapter. It's one of my favorite chapters in the entire book. I should also clarify for our listeners that I misspoke earlier. It's the 17th century, not the 7th century. The 7th century in Japan did not have warriors. They had other things, but not the warriors. So yes, it's the 17th century. But returning to what Catherine was saying earlier, so this focus of memory is quite central in this volume. How do the chapters speak to the roles of memory in various contexts covered in the chapters?
Yes. I think that we brought in how do the chapters speak to the roles of memory? I'm sorry. Well, each chapter is looking at the role of memorializing or memory in sense making, or in how remembering and forgetting, what are their causes and what are their consequences. So this is in large part we borrow on some of the ideas in memory studies. And we look at ideas of collective memory, of collective frameworks, looking at which prompt us to sort of reconstruct images from the past in terms of what they mean in the present. The idea of exploring kind of the motives and circulation of cultural memory, and how it can produce a sense of a community, in a sense of kind of unity in a community or in a group. And so we are, you know, looking at how these ideas of the samurai evolve, or what they mean in any given time, but how what coalesces around them in terms of sort of defining a culture or a time period. So we look at, I guess we could also say, memories, how it functions to negotiate the actual realities of the present with the kind of perceived roles of the samurai at different temporal points. So what's the interrelationship, in other words, between actual realities and perceived realities at any given point, and then a kind of trajectory over time of how that may evolve in various ways, and what the power of it is. And a couple of the papers, if we go back to the papers themselves, illustrate that in very different ways. People really did, you know, back to this idea that we have very different approaches. And, you know, we only have 9 chapters, and that's not a lot to do this giant thing that we're trying to do of so many years and so many disciplines and so many, you know, very different kinds of materials. So, you know, this was a part of what we had to think about. But just to give a couple examples again, Tom Hare writes in his, he's looking at at words in particular, for example, and representing memory in the warrior plays, that he looks at the vocabulary of memory and of remembering in 5 No plays that all have central ghost figures. So, you know, to begin with, these are ghost figures. So memory has to be at the center. And he's exploring who remembers and why they remember, especially in the play Tomonaga, the same one that Monica Beta focused on. And pointing to the complexity and the ambiguous nature of memory in No. And this was one of the interesting things, you know, they both looked at the same play. Out of 9 chapters, 2 people are looking at the same one No play, although Professor Hare also, you know, does put his in with 4 others to bring out what's special in Tomonaga. But the approaches, as you can see, are so completely different that they bring up very different issues. Alison Tokita looks at musical substyles in narrative arts. And so she's looking at memory from a slightly different standpoint. She's looking, you know, these narrative arts that are called katarimono, and especially Heike, Tale of the Heike Recitation, and some dance ballads called kōwaka. So she's mostly, these are all medieval forms, but she also looks in the Tokugawa period and what's happening with these as time goes by. And she's exploring the idea that the formula and musical substyles that are used for specific kinds of narrative content, and in this case, she focuses on content related to war, enhance the memorability of the narratives and their impact. And so she's looking at, you know, what these musical substyles did to make to bring their points to the listeners, to create, to bring those memories into the present, but also to, you know, to not just to bring them into the present, but to kind of bring them alive in the present, to feel them. So these are very different ways in which people have approached the idea of memory related to warfare, and what the ways in which memory continues to have a role in how we perceive our world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, thinking about ways that several chapters kind of talk to each other. We also have Catherine's chapter, which looks at Kabuki in the 18th century. So, you know, we're solidly into the Tokugawa period here. And she is looking at performance practice in the form of monogatari monologues and kudoki, which are laments, in the context, which are, you know, very closely related to the kinds of narrative practices that Alison Tokita talks about in her essay, and, you know, the way that the idea of samurai and gender and gendered samurai identity, and she can talk about this more eloquently than I can, but, you know, but how that gets created on the kabuki stage, and is a representation of things that go all the way back to the idea of, you know, early samurai and samurai identity. And some of the plays that she's looking at are plays that talk about, you know, the Genpei War. You know, so this is yet again another place where kind of the layers of interpretation and transformation in the context of a very different kind of on the ground reality on the kabuki stage in the 18th century, with all of the kind of the material culture around it, including, you know, monogatari being you know, available for people to read. It's a very formative moment in taking very kind of specific representations, and in some cases very conventional, but also, you know, reflecting a kind of tension in the current moment, that you know, that give an identity to samurai for a particular and large audience. You know, and then you've got something completely different, like Luke Roberts' engagement with a set of documents that very kind of very specifically and locally, they're looking at the Tosa domain, you know, look at two different, you know, the documents of two important samurai families, one that was defeated and one that was put in place, you know, and how, you know, how samurai identity is articulated in them, you know, in relation to each other, and then eventually kind of as a larger unit, a larger local unit. So, you know, you have this idea of local identity formation that also has, you know, has resonances as you get into the larger contexts over time.
Absolutely. And all these different perspectives make this volume so rich. It's a shame that we can't have other authors joining us today, but now that you two are here, I guess I can ask you questions about your own chapters. So I guess let's start with Elizabeth. Your chapter focuses on medieval period narratives and their use of the poetic trope of East, which is such a... I read about it all the time in early modern literature, but I never realized this trope. So how did the meaning or nuance of the East transform? And how do these transformations reflect the cultural context of the time?
Okay, well, I'm looking at a text that is from the 13th century. I think it may be the earliest text that we look at in the, you know, in the volume. And so it's, you know, so it's looking at a, it's written relatively shortly after the Genpei War. It's also immediately after the Jokyu Rebellion. So this is it's a moment that it in which things are really transforming. And that's my argument, is that the idea of the East, the Azuma, this space that is out there away from the capital, this space that is the place from which, you know, the Minamoto rise and, you know, eventually set up the headquarters in Kamakura, becomes a meaningful, has always been kind of conceptualized as something beyond the pale, something that is not culturally relevant. But once we have, you know, culturally relevant actors situated there, there's a transformation of the idea of, you know, what it, you know, those actors or the people writing about them. In this case, it's a, you know, it's a memoirist from the capital who travels to Kamakura and comes back. But, you know, the idea that this is now a meaningful place, and it has its own stature as a place from which a voice can emanate. And so that's the kind of general topic that I'm exploring here and looking at this through, you know, a set of poetic exchanges in Kaidoki, which is the memoir I look at, that then seem to be particularly resonant in The Tale of the Heike, which, although it describes a somewhat earlier moment, was written somewhat later.
So it's fascinating. Yeah, I really like that chapter. But of course, I'm a literature person too. So for Catherine, we talked about your chapter a tiny little bit, but in your examination of mid to late 18th century kabuki theater, how do different types of works portray anguish differently? Now we're talking kind of the results of the influences of war. Why do you think they differ in different types of plays in such a way?
Yes, thank you for the question. To answer the question, I guess we have to think about the about gender, about time period, and about genre, actually. So in the 18th century plays that I look at, which are plays derived from the puppet theater, and they're the genre of so-called period plays, jidaimono, in those plays, I'm looking at, as Elizabeth said earlier, two sections, one called monogatari, which of course is a term that goes way back and is something that can be included in many different literary forms, and kudoki similarly, that's also true. And so we're looking at how monogatari and kudoki are adapted into kabuki, most immediately through the puppet theater, but from many earlier forms as well. And so for these, what we find is they're not portraying anguish differently. They're actually portraying it very consistently for each gender. So the monogatari is performed by male characters. The kudoki is performed by female characters, and the ways in which they are acted out and the ways in which they are expressing their anguish are very consistent, actually, within these 18th century plays. And so the anguish in both cases is a response to the demands of samurai ideals, which by the time we get into the 18th century, you know, we're in our second to last century of these many 700 years. These ideals have really been exaggerated for a variety of reasons, but very, very strongly. And so the experiences that these characters have been somewhat codified. And so the men are looking back to a traumatic moment that has defined everything since, and that will affect how they move forward. The women seem to be, or the female characters, I should say, seem to be stuck in this present. They didn't experience that. They're experiencing something as we watch them, which is learning, usually, at least in the main highlighted case I discuss, that their own child has been sacrificed for another. They don't argue with the reasons for the sacrifice, but here they have just discovered it, and this we're seeing their response. So there's really not a past or almost there's not a future for them either in many ways. They're right in the present. So these kinds of characters experience anguish very differently, but male and female characters, very similar. Then when we get into the 19th century, I look at a few other things, dance plays and dance dramas, and explore some of those differences. So again, we've moved time, we've moved genre, and we're not responding anymore exactly to the samurai ideals in these ultra dramatic, you know, just horribly wrenching ways. Often it's more about love or other kinds of issues. So I think those are some answers to your wonderful question.
Yes, and for more answers, I guess our listeners will just have to read your chapter. Now, to broaden this conversation a bit, although this volume covers mostly narratives and performance, and some historical documents, of course. How do these chapters echo broader conversations about cultural identity, national identity, and I guess my personal interest, cultural historiography, both within and outside of the field of Japanese studies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of, you know, the big question is what, you know, what does it mean to be, what does samurai mean to whom and when and for what purposes? And what do you do with that once, you know, once you've decided what landed on an answer? And of course, what I think we are arguing is that on the one hand, there is something there, right, that continues through time. And at the same time, it really isn't a monolithic thing. And there are all of these different ways that is experienced, conceptualized. And, you know, I think we are arguing for embracing that complexity while at the same time allowing the term to have meaning. And I mean, I think that many of the, and this is probably a facile way to explain it, but many of the essays are looking at a set of terms like samurai, like monogatari, or like azuma, or like kidan in the case of Will Fleming's article, that have multiple meanings, right? And that we'd like to allow space for that and give specific interpretations that invite us in to understand those specific meanings while at the same time allowing the term to stand overall. So, you know, we are looking at the cultural identity of the samurai over time, and we are arguing that there is something that can be looked at meaningfully in the way it develops. In the idea that the samurai is a kind of invented tradition is something that has been put forward lots of times, but it's not just that it's an invented tradition. It's something that does go back, right? It's something that developed not just in the Tokugawa period, but over the course of from the Genpei War period forward, and that. You know, the medieval incarnations affect later incarnations, And these you're proto-national by the time you get to the Tokugawa period, probably, but you're not quite national. But there is a cultural identity, and it's a cultural identity that is being formed around ideas that can become national. Now, for example, in Will Fleming's article, he's looking at Kidan. He's looking at stories of the strange. And they always, there's this kind of, China is always a presence there. Many of the stories they have Chinese antecedents, but they're reframed. But there's this idea that there is China there, that this is a response to, and it's, you know, and not necessarily fully a response to, but there's an idea of China that is being formulated in the eyes of writers in Japan, which is also creating Japan to be looking at China. And so that's, you know, so there are, you know, kind of seeds of national identity and the kind of cultural identities that are being formed in the text that we're looking at.
And Qingyu, I know that you're particularly interested in cultural historiography. I think we would say that I think, you know, cultural history, neither of us are historians, but, you know, if we say that cultural history is the examination of records, documents, descriptions of what has happened in the past that try to look at some kind of phenomena over time, then certainly that's what we're doing. So we could say that cultural history is a method of inquiry that it generally informs our volume. You could also say that, you know, cultural studies, which is something that started fairly specific in England in the 1960s, but moved into something much broader. My own department is called East Asian Languages and Cultural Studies, but it's certainly not the original idea of cultural studies for the most part. So, but the kind of way the term functions and circulates now, you know, again, the study of cultural phenomena and looking at how they, how different things, what their meanings are as certain phenomena circulate. You could say that that's a kind of framework for our scholarship as well. So these kind of, I think many people are, you know, looking in these kinds of frameworks in terms of what they look at. And one of the challenges of the volume was to really produce scholarship that would speak to each of the disciplines that our members, you know, our contributors represent. So really to be true to their disciplines, but at the same time, under these broader frameworks, be able to speak to others outside of their fields and a range of kinds of readers. So I would say that those were our goals, and hopefully we met some of them.
I, for one, certainly thank you at all of those goals that you mentioned. But thank you. Thank you for what you said about cultural historiography. And thank you for taking your precious time to join us on this channel today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you. And for our listeners, to read more about samurai and how wars were perceived by medieval and early modern people, make sure to check out Cultural Imprints, War and Memory in the Samurai Age by Elizabeth Euler and Catherine Saltzman-Lee. This is Jing Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies, and I will see you soon.